everyone, and welcome back to another episode of What the Forensics. My name is Nicole, and as always, I'm joined here again today by the lovely Journey and Rebecca. This week, Journey's going to be telling us a little bit about Jerry Brudos, and associated with that, we're going to discuss some fetish disorders and all that fun stuff. And then afterwards, Rebecca will be sharing with us a little fun forensic corner thing. So I look forward to both of those. I would also like to note that there is a listener's discretion advised, as there are detailed descriptions of sexual assault, fetishism, necrophilia, and many other uncomfortable topics. Over to you now, Journey.
Yeah, so I have prepared a really fun episode for everyone, full of just the most interesting topics. I do just want to say, I hope that nothing comes across as kink shaming, because that's not my intention. The fetishes and the things that the paraphilias that we talk about only become issues when they become potentially harmful to yourself or others. So that's more of what we're talking about. So I hope we don't offend anyone with that. But to jump right into it, a paraphilia is persistent and recurrent sexual interests, urges, fantasies, or behaviors of marked intensity involving objects, activities, or even situations that are atypical or potentially harmful to oneself or others. Just straight out of the dictionary. There are three categories to paraphilic disorders. The first is when there is deviant behavior that is directed towards children and other non-consenting individuals. The second involves the pain and humiliation of oneself or one's partner. And the third involves fetish items or an attraction to certain parts of the body or inanimate objects. And so that's the one we're going to go more in depth into for this episode. And a person can be diagnosed with a paraphilia based only on their deviant fantasies, but not every person is going to act them out. And so that's when the paraphilias become issues, is when they start to impact that person's life or others around them. Some experts claim that there are over 500 deviant sexual behaviors, but the DSM-5 only focuses on 9-ish. So we'll focus solely on those as well. And so they are voyeurism, which is having or acting on sexual urges and fantasies that involve spying on an unaware or non-consenting person. Exhibitionism, having reoccurring sexual fantasies, urges, or behaviors related to exposing one's genitals to strangers. Frauterism, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, is recurrent sexual fantasies, desires, or behavioral patterns involving rubbing, fondling, or otherwise touching a non-consenting person. Sexual masochism, which is having sexual fantasies, urges, or behaviors involving physical suffering or punishment inflicted on oneself. Sexual sadism, which is having sexually charged fantasies, desires, or behaviors related to inflicting a form of pain on another individual. We also have pedophilia, which is feelings of sexual attraction to children, becoming sexually aroused by the thought of being sexually active with a child. And I saw a news article that said that they were petitioning to change pedophilia to minor attracted person because it's less offensive to pedophiles.
I heard about that.
Yeah.
Is the sole reasoning because it's less offensive? Or
yeah.
Wow. Okay. Because I was thinking maybe if it's like a person-centered focus terminology, or like, you know what I mean? Like, I identify with this rather than I have this. But if it's just to be less offensive, then I don't know how to deal with that.
There's a stigma around pedophile, like the word. Mm. And so lots of people are like, yes, it's because pedophile is bad.
Yeah
like I totally understand using minor attracted person in like a therapeutical setting, because like if you're actually willing to go out and get therapy to try to fix or solve like that philia, I can understand not wanting to use such a stigmatized word. But if people are like purposely like self-identifying as this because, and like they just don't want to identify with like a word that has bad connotations, and like that's icky.
Exactly. And like one of their biggest arguments is that not every pedophile will act on their feelings, so it's offensive to the people who don't act on their feelings. I don't think we need to normalize pedophilia, so I'm just kind of against the name change. But that's just my personal opinion. So let us know in the comments below how you feel about it. I also don't think it's actually going to change. I couldn't actually find like a reputable news source with it. Yeah. There was just a couple things that were like, this is possibly happening. Yeah. Okay, so then we have transvestism, which are compulsive urges or erratic behaviors related to cross-dressing for sexual arousal to the point of causing clinically significant distress or loss of functioning. We have fetishistic activities.
Right? Right? Okay, it's not just me.
No, I didn't practice saying that word, and I haven't written out a
fetishistic.
Lot.
Fetishistic. Fetishistic?
Yeah, I think so. I also forgot an S when I wrote it out, so.
Fetishistic.
We'll talk about that a lot. And then the reason I said nine-ish was because like the ninth one is other. So that includes necrophilia, zoophilia, partialism, klismophilia, coprophilia, urophilia, infantilism, and telephone scatologia.
Oh. Is that just
I Googled it last night and I can't remember what it was. But it's basically just like masturbating while you're on the phone with someone.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I thought.
But the scat in there made me think it had something to do with scat, but it didn't. So I was like, cool. I think that's coprophilia.
I think it's coprophilia, like coprophilia or coprolites.
Yeah.
Coprolites? Yeah.
That was my assumption. So yeah, those are other. We do, like Nicole said, talk a little bit about necrophilia in here. Not, well, I don't know. Yeah.
You'll see.
Yay, I love this topic. So I didn't research this topic in public. I was like, this needs to be on only my Wi-Fi history and no one else's.
Flagged on every Wi-Fi, every public
literally. I was going to like do some research when I was nannying and I was like, absolutely not. Like if I was a parent and I saw fetish killer on my search history, I don't even know if that's something you could search, like find. Yeah, I was like, no, this is an at-home search. Okay. So sometimes physical desires can manifest in the form of a sexual fetish where you are attracted to an inanimate object or part of the body that isn't genitalia. And it's estimated that 1 in 6 people have a fetish and most can satisfy them in a healthy and consensual way. So unless there is a potential to cause harm to yourself or others, it is not considered a disorder. And the term fetishism originates from the Portuguese word fetico, meaning obsessive fascination. So it kind of, the etymology of the word kind of makes sense with what we're talking about. And research shows that nearly anything can become the object of a fetish. And some common body fetishes include feet, hands, hair, obesity, tattoos, and piercings. Common fetish objects include shoes, gloves, underwear, soiled or not. A specification I didn't need: leather, rubber, skirts, gloves, and wearing diapers. There was also an apron fetish, which I had never considered. Oh. Because the example they had was if you ever look at someone who's wearing an apron and imagine what they would look like wearing only the apron.
Oh.
That's somehow a fetish. I didn't know that. I wouldn't have considered that a fetish. I wouldn't have
either. That's interesting.
Yeah. So that kind of opened my mind to the world of that.
Is this why, like, Kiss the Cook aprons are really big?
Yeah,
is that
probably
kind of the apron, like, that kitchen apron is what you're thinking of, right?
Yes.
That's what I'm thinking of.
When you Google fetish aprons, because I didn't understand.
Tell me more.
I was
Tell
like, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't understand how an apron could be a fetish, but now I do. And so you, they also can be used, I'm assuming, in, like BDSM contexts, where it's more of like a leather apron, like a Dexter apron.
Oh, okay.
Because interesting.
You can buy them on Etsy. That's the first thing that shows up. Now you know that. And for some, they only need a picture of the fetish object. However, many prefer to have the item to achieve arousal. And so inanimate object fetishes can be separated into two types. So there are form fetishes where the shape of the object is important, such as like high-heeled shoes in this case.
Okay.
There are also media fetishes where the material of the object, such as silk or leather, is important. And so a sexual fetish is not unhealthy by definition, but there is a disorder associated with it when it becomes like all consuming. So, for example, a man who incorporates a fetish into his romantic relationship with a consenting partner does not necessarily display an unhealthy behavior. But if that man is so consumed by his fetish that he is no longer sexually attracted to his partner and can only be aroused by his fetish item, that's when it becomes unhealthy.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And so a...
And it's more of like a spectrum thing. Like, it's not just like a hard line of unhealthy. It's like, okay, we're starting to see signs.
Yes.
Let's look into this kind of...
Yeah. Okay. I go into, I think right here, a fetishistic disorder is the persistent use of non-sexual body parts or inanimate objects for sexual arousal to the point of disrupting your everyday life.
Okay.
So once it starts to cause issues with how you live.
Daily. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's defined by the DSM-5 as recurrent, intense, or compulsive desires for sexual arousal from an inanimate object or non-genital body part. The sexual desire manifests as fantasies, urges, or erratic behaviors. There's reoccurring anxiety and significant loss of functioning as a result of the fetish. The item that the person uses for sexual desires is not used because of cross-dressing, because if it was, then it would be an indication of transvestic disorder. When the fetishes affect their mental health or another aspect of their well-being for a period longer than 6 months, it becomes the disorder. Gotcha. That's pretty standard across DSM as it is. And objects used for sexual stimulation, such as a vibrator, aren't considered in the diagnostic criteria for a fetishistic disorder, which I find very interesting because I feel like...
I wonder why.
Yeah. Are they thinking maybe...
Is it because that's its intended purpose?
Perhaps, but I also feel like nipple clamps could be sexually stimulating, but also a fetish, you know, because you can't achieve arousal without that feeling, was my assumption. Sorry, just imagining my parents listening to this.
I'm really trying to hold my tongue. Like, don't knock it till you try it, Journey. I don't know.
But that was my thing because the purpose is sexual stimulation. So, but it can be considered a fetishistic disorder. But I feel like it also could because it's an inanimate
where's the line drawn?
And
why just a vibrator? Like, was it specifically just that object, or are there
in the source it was like, for example, a vibrator.
Then
I'm also wondering if it's like, if its intended purpose is sex, then it's not a fetish, you know? Because a common fetish is like feet or shoes. Those aren't common sexual things.
Okay.
So maybe that's where that line gets drawn. I'm not totally sure.
Fascinating.
But I found that very interesting. And so this fetishistic disorder is most commonly found in men. However, women can develop the condition as well. I would love to do more research into that and kind of figure out why. I thought it was maybe like testosterone levels, but they said that it wasn't because they had done research into that.
Do you know the sample sizes? Like, are there just a lot more men that are being tested, or?
That's a good point. I actually don't know.
Okay.
But yeah.
I'd be curious to see.
Yeah. And so the first indications of an unhealthy fetish can be noticed during the teenage years when puberty begins and an individual becomes sexually active. And there is no known specific cause for fetishism, but some theories include childhood experiences, biological factors, i.e. abnormal brain development, and cultural factors because cultures approach sexuality differently. And so one neurological idea about the cause of foot fetishes comes from the fact that the region in the brain that processes sensory information from the feet is right beside the area that processes sensory information from the genitals. And so there's a neurologist, Vilayanar Ramachandran, suggests
Nailed
that they're...
It.
Thank you. also didn't practice saying that before. So they suggest that there are some sort of like neural crosstalk going on between these two brain areas that kind of results in that. I don't fully understand that because if it's processing the sensory information from the feet, it would be like you, I guess you would get turned on by your feet being touched, not necessarily someone else's feet.
Is it saying, though, it's in the developmental process, there's something that kind of gets overlapped or mixed up in the developmental as the brain's forming?
Perhaps. I don't really know.
And there's kind of just like that in between.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure. But I was like, interesting. Didn't know that those were right beside each other. That's very cool.
Yep.
Some people also believe that fetishism develops from early childhood experiences where an object was associated with a particularly powerful form of sexual arousal or gratification. And other theorists are more focused on later childhood and adolescence and the conditioning associated with masturbation and puberty. So they're kind of looking at all the steps. And there are also behavioral learning models that suggest that children who are victims or observers of inappropriate sexual behaviors may learn to imitate or later be reinforced for the behavior. And certain compensation models suggest that these kids may be deprived of normal social sexual contacts and thus seek gratification through less socially acceptable means.
Right. So if it's just not provided or around them, they'll just find something else.
Yeah, if they're never exposed to a healthy sexual thing. Like, not that you should expose your kids to that, but you know what I mean? Like, if it becomes this whole, like, taboo concept, like, And without treatment, it can lead to negative outcomes and potentially damaging thoughts and emotions related to one's sexuality, their identity, and their ability to enjoy sexual activity healthily. And so this order can be treated, but due to the, like, taboo around sex, the shame the person may feel about it is quite a barrier to actually, like, getting treatment because no one wants to talk about this. And so there are three common methods of treatment, which are just sex therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and medication, which is mostly just SSRIs. They don't cure fetishistic disorders, and they're not guaranteed 100% to work.
Yeah. They help you manage and find ways to rethink. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. They just help you cope and develop healthier practices.
Yeah.
I'm curious if part of the reason for the use of SSRIs would be because of, like, how some SSRIs at least diminish sex drive, basically, or like libido.
Oh.
Possibly.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't really look too much into it because it felt like such a weird answer. I was like, there's no medication to just cure fetishes.
I think, that's fair. I think it ultimately comes down to a wiring of the brain. At least in my opinion, that's what I think fetishism in its sense is. And so, like, SSRIs can help target various parts and, like, manage those connections and communications. So, like, maybe something's lacking in someone with a foot fetish, and providing that SSRI may, like, help connect that channel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That makes sense. Yeah, just rewiring. But yeah, so now that everyone has the uncomfortable grasp on what a fetish is, let's turn to the serial killer aspect, because that's why we're really here. So before we discuss Jerry Brudos, I have an article that was titled 9 Frightening and Grotesque Serial Killer Fetishes. So I'm going to share that with you, but I'm only going to share 6 because the other ones were just like, they killed this person. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I was like, that's actually not a fetish, but whatever. Jeffrey Dahmer preserved his male victims' genitals, heads, and skulls in acetone. He also had sex with their corpses. Ahmed Shiraji drank his female victim's saliva. He was an Indonesian
serial killer. Interesting. Oh, wait. Dumb question. I didn't ask that.
I think they were alive when... I don't know. Yeah. So he...
There's no saliva production when they're dead, so they'd have to be alive.
He was an Indonesian serial killer by night and a cattle breeder and self-proclaimed sorcerer by day.
Cool. I love that.
Cool. I added him to our topic list because the little blurb this article had was very interesting.
Oh, my God.
Ted Bundy would kill his victims and then return to where the body was to have sex with them. He would also, he also had decapitated 12 of his victims and kept their heads in his apartment.
I don't enjoy how many killers have necrophilia. Like, I'm not kink shaming, but I am kink shaming if you have necrophilia.
Yep. 100%. It's super weird. I also didn't realize how prevalent it was in this case. And I was like, I hate this a lot. But just wait, it gets better. Tsutomu Miyazaki drank his victims' blood, violated their dead bodies, and sometimes would eat parts of them. So a little bit of cannibalism in there. He was a Japanese serial killer who is also known as the little girl murderer. So I'm thinking he also had some pedophilia in there, considering all of his victims were between the ages of 4 and 7.
Yeah. Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, he was not a good guy. I think I also added him to our topic list. And then we have Charles Albright, who removed his victim's eyeballs, and they never actually found the eyeballs.
Do you think he ate them? Sorry.
I think it's possible, honestly. I feel like he either like preserved them somehow or ate them.
Yeah, because they were never found, that does make sense. But he also had some like weird things with dolls too, I think, going on there. Or taxidermy. He would taxidermy animals and like he could never get the eyes just right. So I think, yeah. I don't know.
Okay.
Yuck.
Interesting.
Maybe we should learn more about him later on.
Yeah, we'll add him to our topic list too. And Jerry Brudos would kill for a pair of women's shoes, which is an amazing segue into his life and crimes. So Jerry Brudos was born on January 31st, 1939 in Webster, South Dakota, and was the youngest of two sons. He later became known as the Lust Killer and the Shoe Fetish Slayer, which you cannot say five times fast. During his childhood, he was constantly abused by his mother because she had wanted her second child to be a girl, not a boy. And his dad never really abused him, and they just moved around a lot because of his job, which I think is a interesting distinction with this case, because we find with a lot of the killers who had been abused as kids, they were abused by either both parents or primarily their father. And so he also had a fetish for women's underwear, which resulted in him stealing his neighbor's underwear, and he was introduced to the practice of viewing, fondling, and smelling women's underwear by a neighborhood boy who had older sisters. And so they would sneak into their bedrooms and do those things, which evoked feelings in Brutus that he didn't understand, because I think he was still pretty young when this was happening, and he never really, I don't think his parents ever had like a sex talk going on or with him, so he never really quite understood what sex was.
Speaking of Jerry Brudos, reminded me that I have the serial killer coloring book.
Mm-hmm. I completely forgot I had that. Oh my god, thank you for reminding me.
And I like also can't believe that I have this and I've colored in it, but I have. And Jerry Brudos is in this.
I think I have the same one.
I think we would all have the same one.
I think we all had it at one point and we were all coloring together, but yeah.
Yeah.
He's just lovely in there with all the panties and the...
He was, yeah, just a weird guy.
Yeah.
I also have a Charles Albright one, and it's just, there's just like a jar of eyes.
Actually, I think
it might be in
that
one.
I'm going to browse this again.
But I definitely
have
two of them. Okay. While he was in his teenage years, he was a patient at many mental hospitals, but no, like I couldn't really figure out why. So I'm just assuming it was because of his like inappropriate feelings towards women's underwear. Mm-hmm. And Brudos also started stalking local women during his early teens and would often take discreet pictures of them. He would steal lingerie and footwear, and by his mid-teens, he had begun to fantasize about forcibly possessing a woman. Not raping, just, like, taking?
Wouldn't that be kidnapping?
Yeah, basically.
Or just, like, taking control of her and, like... being in control of her movements and stuff. Like.
Yeah. I'm not sure. There's so many things we could read into with the word possess.
Okay. Okay.
But they did specify that because he didn't really know what sex was at this time. So he couldn't understand what rape was, basically. He just wanted to like take a woman and then just be in control of her.
Okay.
Some sources said that he would stalk women, knock them down and or choke them into unconsciousness, and then flee with their shoes. And so these more violent assaults happened the older he got. When he was 16, he dug an underground tunnel and alcove near his family's home. He spent hours in there fantasizing about capturing a woman and taking her there to reenact his other fantasies. And while he never lured anyone there, he did convince a woman to come into his bedroom, where he left, reappeared wearing a mask, and had a knife. He forced her to take off all of her clothes and took photos of her before leaving. He then reappeared saying that the intruder, in quotations, locked him in the barn at knife point. And he kind of like, he like mussed up his hair and like had a, like a different shirt on and like a little cut on his cheek or whatever. And was like, oh my gosh, like I'm so sorry.
No way.
Yeah. Classic. So that's super awesome. I bet it worked.
She probably was so confused and totally fell for it.
You would be shocked how many women he did this to that never went to the authorities.
I mean, I feel like that's very different, though. Not going to the authorities could be part of something else entirely.
Yeah. So a year later, he had developed a pattern of kidnapping girls around his age or younger, forcing them into his family's barn and forcing them to undress and take pictures of them. He would then lock them in a corn crib, which is just like a I Googled it, and it was basically just looked like a chicken wire, like grain bin, but they would just like hold corn on the cob. So it was just basically just a pen for them. And he would come back with a different shirt and hairstyle and claim to be Ed, Jerry's twin brother, who didn't exist. He would release the girls, like feigning shock at what happened and asking them if his brother had hurt them. And he would also say that like Jerry was in therapy and this little act would set him back. And he would ask them to not tell anyone about what happened and that he would destroy the camera and any pictures taken. None of the women were physically assaulted. He just made them strip and take pictures. And it sounds like no one ever tattled because authorities don't know who these women were except for one. Yeah. Because they have.
I'm so curious about why they wouldn't have reported. Like, I don't know if maybe like they're scared that like the cops won't believe them, because I know that was common at the time.
Yeah.
Weird.
I don't know. It's very odd that, because they have all the photos. They just don't know who these women are and no one's come forward.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, I didn't even think about having the actual photos. Because in my brain, I was like, could he just be creating this story or like telling people that this is what he's done? But yeah, there's physical evidence of the photos of these women.
Yeah. And so later that year, when he was 17, he kidnapped and beat a young woman. He threatened to stab her if she did not follow his sexual commands. Luckily, a young couple had been driving by and they heard the yelling that was going on between them. So they stopped to see what was going on before continuing on to the police with them. So they like picked them up and they're like, we're all four of us going to the police right now. And
with Jerry? Jerry was with them?
Jerry was with them. So, like, the couple came by, was like, is everything okay? And then, the girl kind of explained what was going on. And Jerry was like, there was an intruder. Someone else did this. I don't know what you're talking about. And the couple was like, get in. We're going to the cops. Like, this is weird. If there was an intruder, you should say that. Like, yeah. So, anyway, Brutus admitted to attacking her and said that he only wanted to intimidate her into undressing so he could photograph her. And he was arrested shortly after, and they searched his bedroom, and they found his extensive collection of female clothing and all of the pictures of the girls that he had, like, taken to the barn. And only one they were able to identify, and she told them about her ordeal with Jerry's twin brother, Ed. And he was admitted to the Oregon State Hospital for psychiatric evaluations for 9 months, where he was diagnosed with schizophrenia and extreme misogyny.
You can be diagnosed with that?
Apparently you can. Okay. I was like, we need to get
more people into these psychiatric hospitals.
Shit. Literally. I was like, okay. They were like, yeah, it stems from like your hatred of your mother or whatever. Which makes sense.
Classic.
Yeah, okay. That happens. And so he was still able to graduate high school in 1957 because he was able to attend school during the day while at the psych ward and had started.
Physically attend school?
Yeah. He was like, he was released during the day to go to school. Wow. And then he would come back.
I somehow missed that he was not even an adult yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I completely missed that. Oh my god, that's wild.
Yeah,
I think he's seven. We're at 17 right now, I think.
Yeah, 18. Yeah, so yeah, he graduated high school, started work as an electronics technician at a local radio station. There were some reports that he also served in the military for a little while, but was discharged for his bizarre obsessions and didn't last very long in there. So he moved home, lived with his parents during this time. And when his brother would come home, he would be banished to the shed at the edge of their property to sleep in, and his brother would get his room.
Banished. Okay.
Yeah. So his mom really just hated him.
They didn't have like an air mattress or just some pillows to put on the floor, but share room.
They were like, you can have that, but you're sleeping in the shed.
But we don't want you anywhere in this building, actually. See on the property, outskirts of the property.
Yeah, and then as soon as his brother would leave, he would be permitted back into the house. So 4 years after graduating high school, he married 17-year-old Ralphine Schwindler on September 30th, 1961. She was 1 month pregnant at this time. They were introduced by a teenager who would visit the radio station to watch Brudos work because he was an electronics enthusiast.
Okay.
I lost my voice there. He was an electronics enthusiast. And during one of their conversations, Brudos joked about like the kid finding him a girlfriend. And so this kid took him and introduced him to Ralphine. And he was 22 at this time.
He was like, I got a chick for you.
Yeah.
Come on.
And I don't know how this kid was like knew Ralphine. Like, I don't know if they were like went to school together or what.
Yeah.
But yeah. So him as a 22-year-old married the 17-year-old, 1 month pregnant, super happy. The young couple lived in Portland, Oregon for a while before they moved to the suburbs of Salem, Oregon in the summer of 1968. They had two kids, a girl, Teresa, in 1962, and a boy, Brian, in 1967. Apparently, he made his wife do housework naked except for a pair of heels while he took pictures of her as kind of a form of foreplay, I guess. And so she would do these things, and he didn't commit any sexual offenses during these years of their marriage, so it kind of kept him satisfied. But when their daughter
I feel like okay, sorry. Whoa, okay. Stark change with the daughter, but
yeah.
Because I was going to say, like, maybe he had that healthy outlet with his wife and, like, he could express himself in a healthy manner. And then that wasn't enough for him. So maybe it started to escalate.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was enough to kind of, like, keep it at bay because, like, when his daughter was a toddler and his wife was giving birth to their son, she was like, I'm not comfortable with my daughter seeing me like vacuum the house naked. Like this is weird. Like we have children in the house now. So she stopped. Which is totally fair. And so then literally as his wife was giving birth, he followed a woman to her home because he liked her shoes, broke into her house while she was asleep, raped her before strangling her until she was unconscious, and then left with some of her shoes.
All the while his wife's popping out baby number two.
Yep.
That feels like a really intense escalation, like really fast.
Yeah. Because there was, I think, 5 years between the time that their daughter was born and their son was born. So once their daughter turned like two or whatever, the wife was like, nope, no longer am I doing this naked thing. And he had to kind of figure out how to I don't know. It was weird. Quite an escalation. At some point, he started suffering from migraines and blackouts. So to relieve the symptoms, he would steal shoes and lace undergarments from people's houses during the night. He kept all of the items he stole in his garage that he wouldn't let his wife enter without announcing her arrival on an intercom. He also kept
an intercom.
Yeah. Okay. He kept many of actually all of his victims there as well later on. And so I don't know if this like stealing happened leading up to him breaking into someone else's house or if it like I don't know the timeline of when that happened.
Yeah,
but it happened. And then in 1968 he was arrested by Corvallis police while on the grounds of an Oregon State University women's dorm. He was charged with stealing women's clothes and he was wearing women's high heels and underwear at the time of the event, which good for him. On January 26, 1968, a 19-year-old encyclopedia saleswoman named Linda Slauson mistakenly stopped at Brudos's home. She apparently had gotten the address wrong and was supposed to meet with one of his neighbors, but had showed up at his yard because he was working out in the yard. So he pretended that he was the person she was supposed to meet and invited her in. He hit her over the head and strangled her to death. He kept her dead body for some time in the garage, dressing her up in women's undergarments and engaging in necrophilia. He also removed one of her feet so he could put high heels from his collection on it. And he did end up dumping the body in the Willamette River tied to a heavy car part, but her body was never found. And he did keep the encyclopedias she was selling as keepsakes.
Was her what did he do with the foot? Did he dump the foot with the body?
No, he kept it for a while. He like put it in the freezer and then would like take it out and like put the women's like shoes on it. And like take pictures and be gross.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So later that year, on November 26th, he came across Jan Whitney, whose car had broken down on the side of the road. He stopped and offered to help her. And by help, he meant strangle and have sex with your dead body, which he did. And supposedly, she had picked up two hitchhikers, so he drove them to their locations first before killing her in his driveway. He took her dead body to his garage workshop, dressed it, and posed it for photographs. This part is uncomfortable. He then hung her body from the garage ceiling with a pulley for 2 days, and he would violate her body whenever he, quote, felt the need, unquote. He also decided to keep a piece of her body, like Slauson, but he cut off one of her breasts as a keepsake, and his initial intention was for it to become a paperweight, but the epoxy didn't set correctly, so he instead stuffed it with sawdust and pinned it to a wooden board.
Wait, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Proceed. I don't know if I want you to, but okay.
He's so messed up. I have to giggle through this because if I don't, it makes me too uncomfortable.
I don't know how to react to laughing. It's my way of dealing with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So
right,
that happened. There are claims that 2 days after he killed her, someone crashed into his garage, which resulted in like a huge hole in the wall. And so a policeman came over to the scene to kind of like assess damages.
I mean, yeah. You got a car in your garage.
Exactly. And so he like peeked into the hole, somehow missed the body hanging from the ceiling that was severely mutilated. Just left. And so that evening, Brutos tied her body to a railroad iron and threw it into the Willamette River along with Slauson's foot, which had started to decompose even though he had kept it in a freezer when he wasn't using it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so her body was found on July 27th, 1969, 1 month after his conviction.
Oh.
And the next girl he killed was 18 or 19-year-old Karen Sprinkler. He abducted her from a mall parking garage on March 27th, 1969 at gunpoint. She caught his
gunpoint
eye.
Gunpoint now.
Sorry.
Was this first gunpoint now, I'm saying? Like, was this the first kind of escalation to weapons now? Unless I missed it.
Kinda.
Okay. Like, weapons as in gun weapons, because he may have used other,
I don't remember. I feel like...
Okay.
There has always been some form of weapon at play.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't
I was just curious, know. Like, another, like, escalation point, yeah. I guess.
This is the first time where he's like, get in my car.
Yeah.
And so she caught his eye because she was wearing really nice high heels and a mini skirt. And he took her to his home where he sexually assaulted her before he hung her from the ceiling in his garage and killed her. He removed both of her breasts to make molds out of them, and he also engaged in necrophilia with her body. And he tied her body to an engine and threw it into the Willamette River that evening, and her body was found on May 12th.
Where is he getting all of these car parts and iron, like railroad spikes?
Amazing question. Apparently, he would repair cars in his garage to supplement his family income. So he was like a mechanic on the side kind of thing. But like,
interesting.
He tied her to an engine. Like, he just had an engine.
Just an engine.
Just chilling in his garage. And he was like,
that he's willing to dispose of too.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
I was like, okay, interesting. Also, when I say hang from the ceiling, there are some images from Criminal Minds that pop into my head where they like hang them on like a meat hook. That's not what's happening. It's like a noose kind of thing is what's happening.
Oh, okay.
Just so that.
Oh.
I don't know if that makes it
better.
I had
envisioned like hands tied, hung from the hands.
That would also make sense.
Nicer? Yeah.
No, he would like, with I think her especially, that was how he killed her, was he like had hanged her. I just didn't quite know hanged or hung to use, so I figured I'd just specify. In the next month, he attempted to abduct two women. The first was 24-year-old Sharon Wood, who fought back and was able to get away with some minor injuries. The next day, he tried to kidnap 15-year-old Gloria Jean Smith, but when he let go of her jacket, she ran yelling towards a woman working in her front yard, which caused him to run away. And she described her abductor as being in his early 30s, about 6 feet tall, weighing 200 pounds, and wearing dark glasses. And the authorities investigated all known sex offenders, but ended up eliminating, them as suspects. I don't know if he was included in that sex offender list or not because of his like prior issues.
He was charged with what? Like stealing clothing and what else? Like were there any sexual offense charges in that?
Well, like taking pictures of naked women. I don't know if that's, I don't know what like all entailed in his first arrest. So I don't know if he was,
right.
Yeah. I'm assuming he wasn't. But a few days later, on April 23rd, he kidnapped 22-year-old Linda Saley from a shopping center. He told her he was a police officer and showed her a fake badge and claimed that she was being arrested for shoplifting. She proclaimed her innocence, but followed him to his car, where he told her she was being kidnapped for ransom. And he took her back to his house, where he thought his family wouldn't be. On their way to the house, like walking into his house, his wife stepped out onto the porch and told him supper was ready. And he signaled to Linda, who was like kind of behind him, like still outside of his wife's view, like kind of on like the side of the garage, I'm assuming. He was like, just stay there. And told his wife that he would be a couple minutes. So he tied Linda up in his garage and went to eat supper with his family. When he returned to the garage, he saw that she had untied herself, but hadn't done anything else to escape.
Oh,
which like, I don't know if she had just managed to untie herself and it was just like a timing thing. But if I was kidnapped by someone and they tied me up in a garage and I managed to escape and I had like free time, I would leave.
I'm getting the fuck out of there or making noise, banging on shit, alerting whoever's in the house. Was she incapacitated at any regard?
Not yet.
Oh. Not yet. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know. That was just weird to me. So I'm just assuming it was a timing issue and she didn't willingly stay. So he returned to the garage. He placed a leather strap around her neck and strangled her to death as he sexually assaulted her. He then hung her up like the other victims, but he put hypodermic needles into her armpits and then ran an electrical current through them, hoping to animate her body and cause like seizure-like actions. Oh
my God. Is so, so screwed up.
Yeah. It's very weird. It didn't work. And it just like singed the skin where the needles were put into her body.
Yeah.
And so he was disappointed, but he stopped that experiment. And he kept her body for 24 hours before tying her to a vehicle gearbox and throwing her into the Willamette River. He didn't keep any parts of her body, but he did make molds of her breasts, claiming that her areolas were too pink to keep.
Oh my God.
What a, I don't know the word I'm looking for, but like what a shallow thing for a serial killer. Like what a shallow reason not to, I'm not condoning what he's doing.
No, I know what you're trying to say. It's just, it's an odd distinction.
That's,
He's just, his preferences just weren't that, I guess. I don't.
Yeah.
Weird. So on, that was his last victim. So on May 10th, 1969, two fishermen found the body of Linda Saley in the Long Tom River. Her body was too bloated to know if she had been assaulted before death, but they were able to learn that she had been strangled. 2 days later, Karen Sprinkler's body was found by an underwater search and recovery team, roughly 20 meters from where Linda Saley's body was found. Both bodies were bound with a specific cord and copper wire that were tied in like very distinctive knots. And because they were bound to car parts, investigators suspected that their murderer was an electrician or a mechanic. A plus guesses. Yep. Once they identified the bodies, they began speaking to students at Oregon State University, where Karen Sprinkler went. Several female students had received phone calls from a man claiming that he was a Vietnam vet who wanted to take them on dates. And one girl took pity on him and agreed. And lo and behold, the date was not great. Bruto sensed that she was uncomfortable in his presence. And instead of reassuring her that she was fine, he said, quote, think of those two girls who were found in the river, end quote. Which,
oh,
I've never heard of someone going out of their way to make someone uncomfortable in a situation where they are already uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's not alleviating the concerns. Mm-mm. That's kind of compounding to it all.
Yeah, so he must be enjoying this uncomfortable feeling. And he drove her home at the end of the date and asked her why she even accompanied him. And she told him that he had been curious, to which he replied, quote, how did you know I wouldn't take you to the river and strangle you, end quote.
Oh.
So.
Which at this point, I'm really surprised that he actually didn't do anything to her. Like, that seems like a really lucky but strange change of motive.
Yeah.
Do we know if this – no, that's okay. Do we know if this was, like, 100% Jerry Brutos, or was this some just creepy male being like, aha, making a joke. What if I didn't do that to you?
They do know it was him because investigators asked her to contact them if he ever contacted her again.
Right.
Which he did on May 18th, and he was arrested walking to meet her that evening. So that was how they caught him, was through this girl.
Gotcha.
I would like to know why he didn't kill her, though.
Me too.
Maybe her areolas were too pink. I don't know. But like, it's curious because he didn't, like, he killed everyone else. So why?
Maybe different state of mind, different circumstances leading up, different, like, there's so many things that could.
So many. Yeah. So anyway, when he was arrested, he gave them his real name, age, and occupation, but a fake address, and there was no legal reason to detain him. So he was soon released from custody. They did a background check, which showed his history of physical and sexual violence towards women, and his actual address, which was near where Linda Slauson was last seen alive, and the department store where Karen Sprinkler was abducted from. And the 15-year-old that he attempted to murder, the 15-year-old he attempted to abduct also positively identified him, and so this was enough to get a search warrant for his property. Right. So on May 26th, 8 days after his arrest, his property was searched. They found a large amount of women's lingerie, footwear, phone numbers for sorority houses and girls' living quarters, and Polaroid photos of several young women, some of whom were dead, in his garage. And some of these photos were, as we know, were taken in his garage, and one even had his reflection in it. So they were like, he was taking these photos.
That's stupid on his part. Sorry.
Yeah.
Like, oh man. I mean, I can imagine it wasn't intentional that he like was in the reflection, but it also wouldn't surprise me if he would do something like that.
Yeah. I would like to see this photo and see kind of what he looked like at this moment. Like what was his
what
composure?
He's seeing and because I feel like we would get his point of view, but also we're seeing him from the outside. So in the situation as well.
Yeah. Just something I'm morbidly curious about.
Yeah.
So they also found a severed breast coated in epoxy on the mantle of his living room. I hope
in his living room.
I hope that's not true. I don't know if it is or not, but I really hope it's not because that's foul. Like, he has children and a wife in his home.
He's got two children.
And so,
oh my gosh.
And like the one breast that he tried to like epoxy, it didn't work. So unless he like retried, I don't know. Maybe they meant in his garage, not in his living room. I hope that's not true. So they also found the same copper wire that was used to tie the bodies found to the engine parts. They even found a piece of rope in his garage that was tied with the same knot that was found on the bodies. So it was apparently like pretty distinctive knot that allowed them to tie him to those bodies. And they also just found like random car parts in his garage. And so all of this was enough to put him under constant surveillance. And in my opinion, was probably enough to keep him in custody.
Mm-hmm.
Not just surveil him. Like, this is weird. We could probably take him into custody. But by May 29th, they had enough evidence for the abducted the attempted abduction of Gloria Jean Smith to arrest him for it while they looked into these murders. And he was found hiding underneath a blanket in the trunk of their family station wagon while his wife drove to, I think, Portland was where they were going. I don't know why, but they were stopped by highway patrol officers, and that was how he was arrested. That evening, he called his wife and asked her to destroy incriminating evidence, which she didn't do. And I think he was calling from the jail, actually, which is pretty funny. And he was extensively questioned during his time in custody and initially dismissed all the evidence as circumstantial before gradually admitting his fetishes and how they had impacted his life. And by early June, he had given them a full confession to all four murders, which were full of details. He also confessed to his attempted abductions. He took responsibility for the murders, but didn't know what motivated him to kill. He had denied hating women, but admitted that killing allowed him to, quote, let off steam, end quote. And psychiatrists who talked to him said his motivation was lust because he wasn't able to be satisfied with normal intercourse anymore. So it was kind of like a thrill-seeking sexual mm-hmm. thing. And he was formally charged with the murders of Whitney, Sprinkler, and Sally on June 4th. He was never tried for Linda Slauson's murder because there was insufficient evidence because her body was never found. He was mm-hmm. deemed competent to stand trial and entered a plea of guilty to all three accounts 3 days before his trial was going to start. He was given three consecutive life sentences with the possibility for parole.
What? That shocks me.
Yeah. I'm like, if you were given three life sentences.
When are you getting, well, I mean, 25 years, but like.
Yeah.
What?
Why would you ever want that person out on the streets?
That being said, sorry, I did say 25 years, because typically it's like if you're in for life, it's 25.
Yeah.
But did he ever go up for parole before that? I hope not.
Yes, he did. He, okay. He also repeatedly appealed his conviction, but they were all unsuccessful. I think I mentioned it. He was never granted parole, but would attend parole hearings every 2 years for the remainder of his life after being told on June 21st, 1995, that he would never get parole, which feels just like a huge waste of time for everyone. Like, if he's just never going to get parole, then just stop the parole hearings, unless you have like a right to parole hearings. Yeah. I don't know.
He's probably just bored and it gives him something to do.
Exactly.
Hey, my 2 years is up. Let's go for this conversation again.
Exactly. Like, so I guess that was, that would be roughly 25 years after.
Okay.
Yeah. After he was convicted. Okay. His wife was indicted for first degree murder of Karen Sprinkler, even though she insists that she never knew about his crimes and had been forced to drive the car when he was arrested. She was, like, these charges were brought up because there was a witness who said that they saw her helping him force a blanket-covered girl onto their property on the date of Karen Sprinkler's disappearance. Thankfully, the witness later refuted these claims in September during her trial, and the charges were dropped the following month.
Yeah.
Okay. So Ralphine divorced him in 1970, moved states with their two children, and changed her name. So no one really knows what she's up to now. Okay.
Which I don't blame her.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine that. That would be super devastating. And Brutus was a model prisoner, but because he was a convicted sex offender, he was often beaten up. And he would never name his assailants, which is curious to me.
Snitches get stitches.
I guess, but if you're already getting stitches, like, what's the harm? I don't know. I've never been in prison. I don't understand. While in prison, he was also allowed to order magazines or catalogs that showed women in heels and lingerie or underwear,
which I can understand. Yeah. I can understand this in a way of providing a healthy outlet for his fetishisms if it is disordered, like we've come to.
Yeah. Right? It's just a – yeah, and I guess like – they didn't specify like which ones he was ordering, but it could literally just be like a Cosmopolitan where it's just a sexy woman in heels on the cover and that's enough for him.
Yeah.
But he never showed remorse for his crimes and passed away from liver cancer on March 28th, 2006, which is today.
Happy anniversary.
Yay.
Oh, that's crazy. So that was like 18 years ago? 18. I don't know where 14 came from. 17 or 18 years ago.
Yeah, 18 years ago today.
Wild.
Which is, I think it's crazy that we're recording the day he died. But anyway, he was 67 years old and had served 37 years in prison, making him the longest incarcerated inmate in the history of the Oregon Department of Corrections.
What? Really?
Yeah, at this time.
When he passed away. Yeah. Wow.
But yeah, so that's Jerry Brudos. Terrible fellow. Glad he's passed on. And and fetishes. So I hope everyone learned something.
Yeah.
And this will make
a lot.
Yeah. Yay!
It makes me think back to our the sexual offending course that I took in. And it wasn't a course on how to sexually offend. It was learning about sexual offending as a disorder and treatment and stigmas and the mental health aspect around it. But Rebecca and I actually did a presentation on this is kind of related, unrelated, but the use of VR to possibly help people with these disorders.
Oh.
Rather than implementing or acting on their desires in an unhealthy way against a person. You know what I mean?
Right.
And this whole ethical stuff around it and debates and whatnot. But it'd be interesting if he existed in a time where VR was around.
Mm-hmm.
Would that have done anything for him? Would he sought out something else? Would he have been able to satiate his desires in a different manner? I don't know.
Yeah. Or even just this kind of crosses the line into maybe the transvestite disorder, but where men wearing heels isn't as weird today as it would have been in the 1960s, 1970s.
Yeah.
So it might not have been, because one thing, I did miss a slide. I knew it. I missed the whole slide where I tell you how his fetishes started. So he found this pair of high heels in this junkyard and he brought it home and was wearing them, and his mom found out.
Yes.
And she destroyed these shoes in front of him and was super traumatizing. Yeah. So it kind of led into this whole thing.
Kind of idolized it in a way then because of that strong emotional situation, snap, association. I don't know what the word would be for that.
Yeah.
Anywho.
His fetish for women's shoes began when he's 5 years old after he played with high heel shoes in a junkyard. When his mother found him wearing them, she took them away and destroyed them in front of him. And he also claimed that he tried to steal his grade one teacher's shoes a few years later as well because they were nice.
Honestly, he was so young. That was a time where him playing with those heels was honestly so innocent.
Right. Yeah. It's just him exploring and trying something new. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see where that would come from because of the trauma associated with it. But
yeah. Yeah. And they were just spiky heels, which nowadays,
cool.
I don't know, he's five. Maybe just have a conversation with him about it instead of just burning them in front of him and then beating him about it. Anyway, so that's kind of
parenting.
Parenting hacks.
Tips and tricks 101.
Yeah. So I hope you guys enjoyed that.
When he's stealing his teacher's shoes, it's not right off her feet. Right? She's got an extra set somewhere that he's trying to grab and pocket. Or is he right?
I'm sorry, but that mental image is just so funny to me.
Right? I don't know how that would go down. I would assume an extra set of shoes. But I don't remember any of my teachers having extra sets of shoes.
I don't remember any of my teachers wearing high heels.
That's,
spiky, sexy high heels to school.
In elementary school.
Yeah. And it's any weird school. To remember that this, happened in 1950, whatever.
Yeah.
Where, high heels were very different than they are today. So, I don't know. Hmm. It's just weird. But they didn't specify whether or not the shoes were on her feet or not when he was stealing them. He didn't get caught, I guess. This was just something he had admitted, during his confessions and
this is what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay, well, yeah. Thank you. I feel like my brain has grown two sizes and I've just learned so much more. Mm-hmm. Rebecca, do you have anything fun and exciting in the world of forensics or life or the world that you would like to share with us?
I would love to. Okay. So I am actually like so excited about this. Okay. Also, it's not forensics. Like, I don't think it is slightly related to forensics. And I also might be late to the party because turns out this article came out in 2015.
Okay.
But I'm just learning it and I just think it's really fascinating. Also, side note, I'm really sick. So I'm sorry if I sound really congested. Okay. But there was this article I found. Sorry, backing up. So I don't know if you guys had like heard about this fact or not in the past. It's just something that I heard as like fun fact. For like a super long time, spider silk was known to be nature's strongest material.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So they said that spider's silk had a tensile strength mm-hmm. That's almost 5 times higher than steel, which for reference, tensile strength is the maximum stress that a material can undergo before it breaks. So that's super cool. Like spiders can make some super strong material. Yeah. If it was, I think they had said that if spider silk was, for example, made by like a human sized spider,
nope.
They said, I know, creepy image. But they said that a spider's web could like stop an airplane. Wow. Like that's how strong it is.
Holy.
Wow.
I know. Insane.
Yeah.
But somewhat recently, and I say that because, again, this article was 2015, scientists have discovered that there is another natural material that's actually even stronger than spider silk.
Okay. What? Tell me more.
And it's snail's teeth.
Wait.
What?
Teeth?
Teeth.
Yeah.
Snail teeth. Okay, so I was really confused about that, too.
Okay.
I just think it's, first of all, I learned snails have teeth.
Yeah.
Today,
yeah.
Or the other day. But specifically, we're talking about the teeth of a specific type of marine snail called a limpet.
Okay.
So limpets live in intertidal zones, which is like the section of land, basically, where the ocean and the land meet between like low and high tide. So it's like often like the rocks are battered by waves like all day, every day. So limpets live basically on these rocks that are being battered by waves, and they use their like foot, or basically just like their gross slimy bit, and chemical secretions to like hold on to the rock because they're herbivores, and they eat algae. So they eat algae right off of the rock.
Okay.
Okay.
But it was discovered that as they're doing this, they're also using their radula, which is basically a tooth studded tongue. So
cool.
Yeah, their tongue has teeny tiny, like less than a millimeter big spikes, which are basically teeth, and they actually grind down the rocks as they're feeding on it. So they're actually like changing the shape almost of the rock.
Wow.
Right? That's crazy to me. Cool. They're so small.
Yeah.
But because scientists realized that like these snails are literally changing the shape of rocks, they were like, hey, how strong are the teeth on the radula? So they conducted some strength tests. And to do so, because the teeth are kind of curved, I'll put pictures on the website, but their teeth are a little bit curved. So they weren't like the ideal shape to measure the strength without like it kind of messing with the actual results to be comparable. Mm-hmm. So they basically like carved the tooth into like a really microscopic like bone shape with the thinnest part, so the center, being 100 times thinner than a human hair.
Wow.
And they did this and then did like the whatever testing you do for tensile strength and found that their teeth could withstand more pressure than what's needed to turn carbon into a diamond.
Holy.
What? I know. So just like for comparison, because like, yeah, that's a lot of pressure, but it's hard to picture. Mm-hmm. That would be like having a single strand of spaghetti, like really thin spaghetti, and having that hold up 3,300 pounds without breaking.
Oh my gosh. That's insane. Oh,
my Lord.
That's so cool.
So,
wow.
I know. I don't know what the implication of this is. like scientists are saying, like,
yeah,
like scientists are basically trying to study like the composition of the teeth right now, which they're composed of iron dense minerals called goethites and also protein based polymers. And they basically said, like, through researching this, they're hoping to be able to make like even stronger materials that might help in like engineering of airplanes or boats or stuff like that.
That's so cool. Yeah.
Right? I'm so glad you think so.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so that's all I have on that. But
I love nature and the natural world. Holy smokes.
Me too.
Nature is so cool.
Crazy.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing that. Sometimes it's nice to not have a forensic fact, because then it's like brings us back down to reality and the world and nature and nice things.
Especially after this episode. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you both of you for always teaching me something new. Next topic, we are going to be having a little chat about how to not get away with murder, where we're going to just talk about some dumb crimes committed by dumb people and how they ultimately got caught. I'm really excited for that one.
Yeah, I can't wait. I think it's going to be a good one.
And like always, you know where to find us. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at What the Forensics. You can pop on over to X. We may see you there. We may pop in every 6-8 months. We'll say hi. We've got our website, whattheforensics.ca. This is your one-stop shop for everything. We've got our sources, forensics, like Forensic Fridays, little fun facts that we post, episodes as well. If you're having difficulty in any way listening to our episodes through like streaming sites, you can grab them there too. And our email, if you want to just get a hold of us, is whattheforensics@gmail.com. Please review us. We love that. Keeps us relevant. And we're going to keep pounding that into your little eardrums. So do it. 5 stars. This has been another episode of What the Forensics, though. Thank you all for joining us. I had a lot of fun, despite the topic. I did learn a lot, though, and I think we had a great conversation. We hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Just a reminder to everyone that we are not professionals in the forensic science field. We are just interested in forensics and want to share what we are learning with our listeners. We're trying to give you the most accurate information, but we are human and can make mistakes. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope to see you next week.